You know, you get asked all the time. I read a lot of stuff, and I believe in what I read, but there's nothing I'm telling you. I believe more than Milton's. Milton's has been with us since the start. I believe in Milton's 1,000%. I wear their clothes all the time. I'm actually wearing a pair of their shorts as we speak. And I'm going to bring Ken Laird and Mike Menansky there. I'm going to bring Ben Kincha there, my producer, as well at some point, to clean him up because you look like a slob. You need a Milton's makeover.
Do I really? Hold on. Wait a second. Compared to the other producers?
Well, I understand that. But I'm saying even, you know, you could you use a couple of nice shirts? Nice pair of shorts.
I love the guy who in a baby blue t-shirt right now with nothing on.
Well, this is not a Milton shirt.
Is telling me, and I'm wearing
that. That's what I'm saying. I'm not wearing a Milton shirt. That's the point.
You look worse than me right now.
Yeah, but when I wear Milton's, do I?
No.
No, I do not.
I'll
admit that. That's the whole point.
You
Milton's.
Look good. I'm surprised at how well you actually clean up.
It's nice of you to say. We were at, Jerry and I were at Foxwoods. No, Jesus. I'm an idiot. Mohegan Sun for the Johnny Damon thing a couple of weeks ago. Went kind of well, like only ours can. And there was a Tommy Bahama store there, and there's a couple of great shirts there. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go to Milton's to get these. I know they're going to have them. If you're a guy my age, you want some nice stuff for golf this summer, knock yourself out. You get some nice shirts. You get some nice shorts. By the way, you want a couple of suits for a wedding? There's going to be 3 million weddings. Nobody wears the tuxes anymore. You go to Milton's to get the suits. They take care of you. You can wear the suits again and again and again. You saw us at the White House. That's Milton's. You cannot go wrong with Milton's. They make guys like Ken Laird and Kirk Minahan and Chris Curtis presentable. That's really all you need to know. They make Chris Curtis look presentable.
They should get some kind of Congressional Medal of Honor for that.
They really should. I mean, you can't top that.
He's a weird-looking person.
He is, and they make him look good.
And I told him he looked really good when he went down to the White House with you guys.
That's where you go. You either go to South Shore Plaza or you go to Chestnut Hill in Chestnut Hill Square. Chestnut Hill there. You go to Milton's. It is the store for men. All right, first, enough about me in a couple of weeks. First one I've done in the studio in a few weeks anyway, since the last one. This one is with Jason Wolf, my first program director, the guy who brought me in, I guess, in a way. We talked about everything. Wolfie had a long run at EEI. He's been there since the start. Talked about bringing me in. We talked about the whole Salk experience. We talked about Glenn being fired. We talked about John and Jerry. Talked about Eddie Andelman. We talked about the history of EEI. We talked about the future of EEI with this merger, what that means. Kind of covered it all. Wolf did a good job. He was a little, he was Wolfie. He was a little, really smart, a little guarded, didn't quite give you everything, but I think we did a pretty good job. We're going to split this up into two parts, correct?
Absolutely.
It's a two-parter with your old boss as well, right? Yeah, Wolfie was your boss.
He was the one who hired me here.
There you go.
He was my fifth program director, but he was the one who hired me here.
We've had two since. So Wolfie was here for program director for, what, 20 years? Whatever.
Almost,
yeah, I mean, he had an unbelievably long run.
17 or 18 years.
Yeah, and he started as a producer here for Eddie way, way back in the day. So we get into everything. I think we split up into two parts, correct?
Yep.
So where do we end this part with? Don't know yet?
I don't know where I'm going to split.
Okay, but it's running today.
It's running today.
This is a tight ship we run here.
All right, yeah.
We'll find a place to cut off somewhere. Oh, how long is it in total?
In total, it's an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay. And we actually taped it, by the way, I should say, in the actual studio itself, where we do the show.
I know. You start off talking about that. You're very impressed with yourself, the fact that you started it off in there.
I think it's our only one, right?
It's the only one you've used that studio for.
I think. Yeah.
Everything else has either been in Studio K
or
Studio
Meter's old booth, right?
Meter's old booth, which
yes.
smells like shit.
It really does.
And it's tiny and it's cramped.
It's the worst. Okay, so Jason Wolf.
It's like Meter.
It's true. Jason Wolf in studio, a two-parter. You'll enjoy it. If you like inside radio stuff, you're going to enjoy this one. Jason Wolf, my old program director at WEEI, is the guest on this week's Enough About Me. All right, we're here. We're doing this is the first podcast I've done in the actual WEEI studio, the new studio. I don't believe Jason Wolf has ever seen until right now this new one, kind of new one.
I have not.
We updated all the way to like 1986. We moved about 10 years forward.
I missed the old logos with the Nessun logos on them.
Oh, Jesus, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, in a while.
I don't know what happened to that. I don't know what happened with Nessun. I think you remember. You
Something
were there
happened.
For that.
I don't know.
You were there for that.
I was there.
So what's going on?
Everything's good, Kirky.
Yeah.
Keeping busy, rocking and rolling.
Yeah.
Living the dream.
What is the, when you listen to the state, first of all, do you listen to sports radio a lot or no?
Not as much as you might think. I don't have as much time.
Yeah.
I think over the last couple of years, it's trailed off a little bit. There are certain times of the year when I'm more into it than other times of the year, but for the most part, I consider myself a casual listener, and I go back and forth probably like most people, but it's not a daily routine for me.
When was your first day of employ at WEEI?
My first day was August 26th, 1991.
And your role was?
I was a producer.
For?
I was the first producer for The Dale Arnold Show,
yes,
which aired from 10 to 1,
yes.
And the Glenn and Janet Show. I'm not going to sing that jingle, so don't ask.
Okay, that's
They were on from 1 Prensky. To 4.
So you produced, so two shows, 6 hours.
Correct.
And that was, so Dale solo was what, guests, lots of guests, lots of, what was your role there?
Yeah, well, Dale was a really good interviewer. I think he still is a good interviewer, but he liked guests.
Yeah.
The station in the old days was really built around guests.
I remember, yeah. You
know, there was just not the same kind of passion for subject matter as there was for let's hear what X guest has to say. So,
yeah,
I think the first show we produced, we had 6 guests right off the bat. Boom, 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 6 different subjects and think, wow, this is the greatest thing ever.
Right.
It wasn't so great, but we learned. We figured it out.
It's weird. Yeah, it's so strange how it's changed, though, from, say, then to now. Like, I'm not even saying we, I mean, obviously, I think what we're doing works, but I'm not saying what's right and what's wrong, but, like, back then, you didn't really, it was still in its infancy. You didn't really know any better. You didn't know what was working and what wasn't working, right?
Yeah, we had absolutely no idea. I mean, honestly, we were sitting there saying from day to day, should we put this guest on because the Celtics are playing the Pacers at the Garden?
Right.
Or the Bruins are playing the Canadians at the Garden. Whatever it was catered to what was happening on that night as opposed to today where it's all about issues.
Right.
It's very issue-based, and people are, I think, far more passionate about those issues than they might have been. I mean, Boston, as you know, has always been an incredibly passionate sports city, one of the best, if not the best, in the country.
Right.
But when sports radio first started, I mean, you got to remember, the first sports station, WFAN, launched in 1987. There were only about 15 or 20 of them by the time EEI launched in 91. So yeah. I don't think anybody really had blueprint for what to do. They just went instinctively and determined what was the best decision from day to day.
What was the, so I knew those two shows. Was the morning show at that point when the station started, was that Andy Mose or no? Doyle
it
and
was,
Mustard?
Yeah, it was Andy Mose. It was called the as yet untitled morning show,
right?
Because they didn't know what to call it.
Right.
So that's what they called it. Andy Mose was the host, and there were there was a male co-host by the name of Rob Buttery and a female co-host by the name of Suzanne Lee. And I'm not sure what happened to either one of them, but it was supposed to be a lifestyle, mix of lifestyle and sports, a little bit of news. Never really got off the ground. I mean, Andy, as part of the old Joe and Andy family,
right,
on what then was Mix 98.5, was an excellent FM morning show.
Yeah.
Had a lot of big-name musicians that came in,
right,
other artists. He had a great following in Boston. But he wasn't really the right fit for what I think they wanted to do with that show. And it lasted maybe a year, a little more than that, and then the decision was made, we're just going to put a sports show in there. So that's where Doyle and Mustard came in. And Doyle, obviously, was the comedian, and he didn't have the institutional knowledge. But they could talk about the games and the teams, and they did a better job than
that. You know, Jerry says this all the time when we talk about him. I feel like if Craig Mustard had wanted it bad enough, he could have been like a big Boston sports host, day in, day out host. You know what I'm saying or no?
Yeah, maybe. He was actually the first sports host that EEI hired.
Right.
Before it became an all-sports station.
Yeah.
2 years earlier, EEI was a news station. People don't remember that EEI has been in the sports format so long now that prior to that, it was a news station. BZ was not doing news.
Right.
He was doing all talk.
Yeah, talk, yeah.
Right. So when Mustard came in from New York, they put him on 7 to midnight, and he was in and around both the Bruins and the Celtics.
I remember, yeah.
Which the station had the rights to both of those teams at that particular time.
Right.
So I think it took a while for people to get used to him because he was a New York fan. He had New York mannerisms, but he was a very, very smart guy. And I think, to your point, if he really wanted to do more, he probably could have done more. I think he was comfortable doing what he was doing, and he had a pretty big role at that time.
Do you think to be a big radio personality in a big market, you have to be a little, I don't want to say determined, but you have to be a little off in some way. You almost have to be hyper-competitive and hyper-focused.
Oh, no question. You have to have an edge.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys that can talk sports and do it intelligently.
Right.
But there are very few that can do it and be entertaining. and compel the audience to react. And I think those are a real select few, particularly now.
Well, yeah, it seems like it's now, it's weird. There's more stations than ever. We were talking before we started. There's basically TV shows that are trying to be talk shows now. Comcast is trying to do it. But it does feel like there's fewer talented people than there was 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe everybody always says that, but it does feel that way in a weird way.
Well, it's hard to find the diamonds in the rough.
Yeah. You know,
there's a lot of people, men and women, who can do the same thing. And you know, you could just line them all up, pick one, and you're going to get what you're going to get.
Right.
It is what it is.
Could Eddie Andelman be a success in today's, if he was 52 years old and still doing the same thing, would that work today?
That's a hard one.
Was he smart enough to know that he would have to adjust and adjust properly?
Yeah, I think he was smart relative to what the people wanted.
Right.
I mean, when he started, it was all about his personality with the two other guys. I mean, that old Sports Huddle show, for whatever people thought of it, was a classic sports talk show.
No question.
I mean, terrific show.
Definitely.
And they were excellent together, and their chemistry played off each other. I think Eddie liked being the fan. He knew he wasn't a great broadcaster. He knew he wasn't the most knowledgeable person. He loved to say silly things like, the hockey net should face the other way stuff like that. But I think if he was doing it today, he would certainly be smart enough to know that he would have to adjust.
You know what hurt Eddie was the internet, because all of a sudden people started looking up facts and saying, well, wait, that's not true. It was like a weird adjustment period. But so what was your relationship with him before you were his program director? You were his producer.
I was his producer. So we had a great relationship.
So you went from – so Glenn and Janet got axed, and they moved
– Well, they decided that wasn't going to work. Janet left.
Okay. So
Glenn did the show on his own.
Right. So where were you – then when did you start producing Eddie's show?
In 94.
Okay.
94, 95.
And then obviously the only people I've worked with who have worked with Eddie are Dale, Jerry, and John. So you must have some idea of what they have told me about him. It might be different than what
I think I have an idea of what John would tell you.
Well, Jerry and Dale, I think Dale had an up and down relationship with him, right? It seems like...
Yeah, but Eddie would never admit it, but he liked working with Dale.
Yeah.
He appreciated the fact that they could go at each other, and it was real.
Whose idea was that to put them together? You?
No, that was Glenn's idea.
Glenn's idea, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the idea was to have a yin and a yang, to have a fan against a broadcaster, to have somebody who could play off each other, to have two people who could play off each other and not ever agree on anything. And I think Eddie was clearly the dominant personality when that show first started. But you remember, he was still a major player in the marketplace when it first started.
Yeah, so, huge.
And Dale had done well to improve his profile and push his way up the ladder. And I think that, frankly, helped him evolve into a much better talk show host, because he knew that he couldn't just sit back. He had to challenge the other guy, in this case Eddie, and that led him to being able to challenge guests, challenge callers, challenge other hosts. I think he did well with it.
When did you become the program director?
In 1997, September.
1997, September. So the lineup then is John and Jerry are not yet at 6:10?
No, it was Imus in the morning.
Still Imus, right?
And the Fabulous Sports Babe was on at 10.
Oh, so John and Jerry weren't even 10 to 12 yet.
Correct.
Okay, and then you have what?
And then at noon, it was Eddie and Dale.
Yeah.
And 3 to 6 was the big show.
It was the big show.
The old big show.
So me as a teenager or whatever, driving around, like, I knew that the Fabulous Sports Babe on the EI made no sense. So I'm sure you knew the Fabulous Sports Babe on the EI made no sense, right?
Sure.
So why was she on the EI at the time? Just because it was cheap?
It wasn't even cheap. It was free.
Free, right.
It was, I think at the time, the station didn't want to invest in a live and local lineup.
Right.
I should say all local lineup.
So you weren't local until noon.
Right. In the old days, we weren't local till noon. So, it took about a year, and when I got named program director, one of the first things I said was, how long are we going to keep these syndicated shows?
Well, how was Imus doing?
Well, when he first went on, he was incredible.
It was a big deal. I remember that.
It was a huge deal. His numbers were off the charts.
Right.
But more than that, he was probably responsible for 35 to 40% of the billing on the station.
Right.
So there was no reason to think about moving him out.
Right.
The Fabulous Sports Babe, she's a great person. I always got along with her.
Oh, sure.
But, she's doing national sports in a local market, and it just didn't make a lot of
sense.
Especially
this local market.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. And she was I think she was a fan of the Boston teams.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't a good fit. So when John and Jerry, John was just coming out of his deal with Channel 7. Yep. Jerry was co-hosting the Big Show, and he had some other deals going on. We put that deal together for the two of them to do 10 to 12. And that was our first step towards ultimately live and local lineups. So but, to answer your question about how Imus was doing, once John and Jerry came on in the afternoon, Imus started to slide back
10 to 12.
Quite heavily.
Yeah.
10 to 12,
yeah,
excuse me.
It was originally supposed to be Bart Cannon and Jerry, right? Is that right?
He was in the mix.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was originally thought of.
Maybe
we
thinking,
weren't
let's
sure.
Build a show around Jerry Callahan and get somebody else to work with him. Like, you liked him so much in the Big Show that he stepped. Like he, you said, I want this guy to have a bigger role.
I thought he could definitely handle doing a show of his own.
Yeah.
I thought that sure Dino and Barkan were the two best candidates to match him with. I wanted a broadcaster with him. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to be able to be himself and not have to worry about the formatics of anything.
Yeah.
Dino was my first choice, but I wasn't sure if we were going to be able to get him from Channel 7, so I had Barkan in
the bullpen. So when you got Dino and Jerry together, it took, you said, excuse me, what, about a year before they went in the mornings, or no?
It was, they started in the fall of 97, and we moved them in the fall of 99. I'll never forget this, we did a research project.
Yeah.
I mean, a real research project. We actually talked to 500-600 people in the market.
Right.
And you get real information about what people think about your radio station.
Yeah.
And the number one thing that we noticed was that people started to forget when Imus was on the air.
Really?
So it wasn't even that they loved or hated him. He was now irrelevant.
That's the worst.
And that was the kiss of death for him. And then we knew it was time to make a move.
And then that was kind of then at that point you sort of had your lineup. It was John and Jerry. It was then Dale and Eddie. And then the Big Show, right? And that was sort of the lineup for what, 4 or 5 years till Eddie left? Does that sound about right? Maybe a little less?
Yeah, Eddie was there from, well, we expanded the show. Remember, he was on from noon to 3, and we made it 10 to 2. Glenn was on from 3 to 6. We made it 2 to 6. Dale and Eddie and the old Big Show lasted were together, I'd say, back-to-back for about 4 or 5 years, and then Eddie left.
What was the biggest issue at that time in terms of handling egos? Who was it? Was it Dino? Was it Jerry? Was it Eddie? Was it Glenn? That's a lot of ego.
I don't know that there was any one thing. I mean, you can't treat everybody the same. You got to treat them who they are. You try to make decisions that were best for the station. I think the biggest, I said this even up until the day I left. Every decision I made, I wanted it to be made because I thought it was in the best interest of the radio station. If it wasn't, it just wasn't going to work.
In my
opinion.
Right. But I would say, and now we're going to jump forward before we jump back again, you would agree that toward the end you had to make, or you were involved in some decisions that you probably knew at the time weren't the best for the radio station, but you kind of had to make them to go along, to get along. Is that fair?
Well, I knew they were very risky moves.
I'm thinking of one in mind specifically, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Well, it was a terrible situation.
Kevin Winter, yes.
Didn't work out.
It was a terrible thing.
He should have been better.
We all got through it. Did you want Mike Salk to replace Glenn Ordway?
No.
No. Did you say that in meetings?
Sure.
You did. So when did that start? So that happened. Glenn left right about when I went in with John and Jerry, within 2 weeks of each other, maybe a month, give
something
or take.
Like that,
I don't know, whatever it was.
Well, to understand the whole Salk thing, it's really not about Salk. It's more about Glenn.
I agree.
And,
well, yeah, but go ahead. I'm not sure I agree, but go ahead. Go ahead.
You'll get it. Okay. So, in every talent gets to a point where one of two things are going to happen. They're either going to be so good that they're going to leave on their own to go to brighter pastures.
Yeah.
Or three things. They're going to get fired for doing something stupid or having lack of success.
Sure.
Or they're going to price themselves out.
Okay.
Where you get to a point where you just, for the good of the rest of the station and the rest of the team, you just can't afford to make that kind of a move.
So that's where we are with Glenn.
So in 2007...
Mm-hmm.
Glenn was already making a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that CBS was going to go all sports.
Right.
I didn't know when. I thought it was going to be on 104.1 because everybody knew BCN was going to fizzle out at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love Glenn. I go back with him more than anybody.
Right.
But given what he was asking for, I had real questions as to whether or not we were going to be able to do it.
This is 2007.
2007.
Okay, go ahead.
This was the spring of 2007. He signed in the fall.
Okay.
And at the time, I sent an email to corporate, and I told him, this is what I think you should do. And I put together my own proposal. This is what I would pay him if it was up to me.
Right.
And I thought it was very fair. It was still a huge increase from where he was, but it wasn't going to put the rest of the radio station and the lineup at risk because he wanted a seven-figure deal. Mm-hmm. And the company decided to give him the seven-figure deal. So it is what it is. But at that point, my job was, we might not have this guy, either because he wants to leave on his own because he's not happy with our offer, or we're just not going to pay him.
Yeah, right.
So the guy that I identified to replace him was Felger.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I hired him to do as much filling as he did. That's why he was doing weekend shows. He was writing blogs.
I was working with him, yeah.
There were a lot of things that he did. And I had numerous meetings with him, numerous.
With Felger.
Off-site.
Yeah.
Where I said, look, I honestly don't know whether we're going to be able to re-sign Glenn or not. And so if we don't, you're my guy. I want to put a deal together for you. And he was interested, but he didn't want to do anything until he knew for sure that we were moving on. So I made the proposal to corporate and said, look, this is what I think you should pay him. I don't think you have to do a nickel more than this, because if he doesn't take it, we have a solid replacement right here and we're ready to go.
Right.
And I said, if you do give him what he wants, I have concerns about how that's going to affect us down the road. Maybe not initially, but
a couple of years down the line.
Who knows how long could it take? And as it turned out, it didn't take that long. But yeah, that was that's how that whole situation came down. So the Salk thing is way after the fact, because if we had done I think Glenn would have accepted the deal.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, because he knew what he had here.
Right.
He knew what was built around him. You also got to remember, we were spending close to $300,000, maybe more than that, on people to surround him. So it wasn't just paying him seven figures. It was paying all these other people to be part of the show.
And I will say, and I'll get back to it, but I would say it's something that Jerry and I have said. In a weird way, though, if I said to you, you're going to pay Glenn and then two other hosts of the Big Show every day, you pay him each $150,000, you'd say that's a pretty good deal for those other two guys, right? For an afternoon drive time.
If Glenn's making a million?
Well, no, I'm saying forget Glenn for a second. Just isolate those two guys. Like, that way you're...
Yeah, I would say that.
Like, that's what I would say for the third guy with us. I mean, technically, you're saving money.
Maybe.
Again,
at that time, the station was making a lot of money.
Right, yeah, okay? Right.
It's not that they couldn't afford to pay people.
Right.
But eventually, you get to a situation where if you're loading all of your salary up on one show...
Well, John and Jerry were making a lot of money, I'm sure.
They were at the time, sure.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no doubt. But so fast forward. So you say it's not about Salk, but I will say this: like, the first time I heard Salk, I was like, I know this is not going to work. This is not going to work. I mean, you must have sat there. Like, were you involved in the decision making process, or is that Jeff Brown saying, "I want this guy"? Like, how does Mike Salk arrive on the radar screen?
Well, he wasn't my first choice.
Why was I never discussed?
Why weren't you ever discussed?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Looming star.
Well, maybe today you are, but I don't know. I mean, look, there were... So we move ahead now.
6 years.
4 years.
4 years. I thought you said it was seven. Now we're going to 2013.
Well, he started in what, 12?
Who, Glenn?
Salk.
About 13. Right when 13. I did.
Oh, 13. Yeah. Okay, so 6 years.
Whatever.
You're right.
Yeah.
See, I've been gone, so I don't remember my dates as much as you do.
I understand.
So again, we're at a point where Glenn was making the big money, then they cut him down.
Right.
Everybody remembers that.
Yep.
And so it's now we need to do something again. This is corporate's position was it's probably time to move on from Glenn.
Right. I mean,
we need to find a replacement.
I mean, you would say Glenn and Hawley just didn't click.
They didn't click.
It was okay.
Yeah. I think some of it was a chemistry issue between the two of them, which I thought was kind of interesting because Hawley had co-hosted on Glenn's old Big Show many times.
Yeah.
And it's not that they didn't have a good rapport together and didn't know each other.
Right.
But, you know, this is all combined, Kirk, with Dale and Holly were doing really well
right.
in midday. And what's the point of breaking up a real good show like that? If you do it, you're going to wind up breaking up the other show, because the reason it happened is because Holly wanted a better contract, and the only way to give him a better contract was to move him to a more profitable day part.
So now we're getting stuck again. But we'll get to Glenn in a second. So why then fire Dale, though?
Why not? It didn't have to happen. It didn't have
to happen. So you didn't want to do that either?
Well, I didn't want to make every decision based on money.
I thought
that we were focusing too much on how much we were spending and not enough on what kind of content we were getting
right.
from the guys. I mean, Dale might not have liked it, but I think if we had gone to him and said, hey, listen, we got a situation
where
we need to cut your pay to X.
So that was never discussed.
He wouldn't have been happy, but I think he would have taken it.
Okay. Oh, so I didn't even know that. That was never talked about beforehand. So you just...
No. We,
okay.
The decision was made to go find the best $60,000 a year guy you can, and that's
right.
what I did.
Instead, you got Mutt. Man, that can
Instead,
happen.
Instead, I got Mutt. Yeah,
tragedy.
No, but and look, I know this is going to come off in some way like corporate came down with a hammer and you got to do all these things. There were a lot of conversations that were going on, and the other station was rising,
clearly. Sure.
And so there was pressure, and there was a lot of discussion at the highest levels about
right.
what should or shouldn't be done. When you're sitting there writing those checks and you're seeing numbers come down, you're seeing revenue go not only across the street but out of the building, you're well within your rights to sit everybody down and say, we're going to make some tough calls here.
Sure, I get that.
This is what we have to do. So we just made the wrong calls.
Right.
That's what it came down to. But and I don't even want to keep getting back to this, but in terms of...
back to what?
Salk.
No, but my question is, who heard him and said, I want this guy to replace Glenn Norway and be on in the afternoons of Boston?
Well, I had...
Whose call was that ultimately?
I had to make the call that... I had to accept the fact, I should say, that Glenn was going to be moved.
Yeah, right.
Period. So go find somebody else. The first 25 guys I called, they just weren't available. What can I tell you?
That's what it is.
I'm kidding. No, the guy that I really wanted was Ryan Russillo.
Yeah.
I thought that he had enough success in town. I had had a number of conversations with him about coming back. I thought he was... Of all the ESPN radio guys, I thought his personality lent itself best to be included in a local lineup. He knew Holly from before. He had relationships with people in Boston from the time he was here.
Yep.
And I thought that he would have been a solid replacement. And frankly, I was looking forward to managing him on one end and Dino on the other.
John, the other,
that
would have
been kind of funny.
We had Russillo on the Super Bowl for like 20-25 minutes. It was interesting. It was different. He has a different pace, but it was okay. It would have been interesting.
I think he had it in him though.
Maybe.
To be more of the edgy, in your face personality.
Well, I think he was more like that when he was in Boston at 15-10 than he is at ESPN now. Obviously, I think.
Well, yeah, because right. ESPN has it. They want it a certain way.
Okay, so that doesn't happen.
So it didn't work out. Right. So there were a number of other people that I listened to and looked at. Ultimately, Salk was in that group. We didn't move quick enough to get Russillo. We could have had him.
Anybody else we know in that group?
No, probably not.
No.
It was a tough call. You know, I ultimately understand why people are going to put that one on me, because I did listen to him. I talked to him. I spent a lot of time with him.
Right.
I think that was one of the things that was most interesting about it for me is... I probably interviewed him more than anybody I interviewed for that role. And frankly, he did a good job selling me that he was going to be able to come in and do a solid job. But afternoons, under the cloud of everything that had gone on prior to that, it was pretty close to a no-win situation. And I was in a meeting with corporate prior to this all coming up to the surface.
Yeah.
And I was asked point blank, if we make these moves, the two moves consecutively, Dale and Holly are going to get broken up. We're going to move this way. What's the percentage that's going to work? And I said, at best, it's going to be 50-50.
Yeah.
Probably less.
Right.
But that was good enough.
Yeah, so they made the move.
We're okay with it.
How long did it take you to realize that this thing just was not going to work?
Not very long.
No.
I sat him down a lot in the first couple weeks, month, 6 weeks, and told him flat out, if you don't fight back against everything that's coming at you, the town will eat you up.
Right.
I know that's not what you thought this was going to be, but neither did we.
Right.
You got to figure it out as you go along.
A lot of that was me early on, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you guys didn't help him.
Right.
You crushed him.
Right.
You frankly made sure that he didn't make it.
Which helped me.
It ultimately helped you.
Right.
But it didn't help me.
No, I'm sorry about that.
Because I'm sitting here with you now.
I'm sorry about that.
But at the end of the day, if he had... I'm not going to say it. I was going to say, if he had stepped up and been a little bit tougher and not taken it so personally, he might have had a fighting chance. But I just think it was a bad fit. You know, it was there was too many negatives surrounding the whole thing at the time. And, you know, we were in a difficult position. The other station had taken basically 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years, and were almost on par from a ratings perspective, and then far surpassed us.
That surprise you, the speed of that? And I mean,
It surprised me that they were that they grew past us so quickly. But I think part of that was the frequency. When they launched on that station, they were reaching a demographic that, frankly, was not familiar with EEI.
I know, and we do this, and people say, "Oh, but there is truth to it." And listen, they had great ratings and still do, but you know.
But
try and listen to 850 right now.
You can't.
I mean, it's like 1947.
It's tough. I think the biggest thing that could have happened if everyone would have just taken a step back at that point is, look, this other station's going to launch. It's a fact. Okay.
Right.
Now, who are they going to launch with? Their afternoon show is going to be two former EEI guys.
Right.
Half their midday show is EEI. Well, nights, let's leave nights aside for a second because there's games on it.
Well, the only outlier are Touch and Rich.
Correct.
Right.
Who had a miserable experience in Boston from a ratings perspective until they went on 98.5.
So when you first saw, because sort of the narrative is, you know, I remember reading that story in Boston Magazine by that guy Alan Siegel or whatever. There's a sort of narrative that EEI sort of said, oh, fuck, it doesn't matter. They're nobodies. You know,
That is absolutely not what was what
right. Well, that's what I'm asking. That's not reality.
My point was
right.
We need to be okay sharing the audience,
right? Because they're familiar with a lot of those guys.
It's okay.
Right.
The town is big enough for two. We can still run a great business. We shouldn't worry about beating them by 12 points like we were when they first went on the air within the first month.
Right.
There was too many factors playing against us to be able to maintain that. And so then you fast forward to the 2 years later when EEI finally did move to FM. By then, you had a station that had already had a huge head start talking to new listeners. Mm-hmm. And so all those young people, even today, they are loyalists forever to 98.5.
Yeah.
But that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. So let them have the younger group. EEI has the older group. I think it still could have worked out to our benefit if we were playing on bit of an equal playing field.
So why'd you get fired?
I guess I took the bullets for all the decisions that were made. I mean, I made mistakes. I'm not suggesting I didn't.
What's the biggest mistake you made?
The biggest mistake I made was allowing, I think, everything to be determined based on how much money we
salary.
Were spending.
You know, right.
It should have been more about the quality of the content that we were producing, which was still quality content. But look, every group has to decide when it's time to move on. If the manager can't control the players, or if the manager has lost the clubhouse, so to speak, and I think they felt that I lost the clubhouse.
Do you feel like you did? I mean, I was in that clubhouse.
Yeah, I think
end.
To a certain degree. I think I did with you guys for sure.
With me, John, and Jerry?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Because you guys had your own understanding of what you thought was going to be best for the station.
Right.
I think I had different thoughts at that point. I certainly didn't want you to beat the living shit out of our new afternoon guy day in and day out. That wasn't doing me or him or me any favors. But it was what it was. And a month before they let me go, we were at a corporate meeting in Minneapolis, and I said as much, that, look, we have tough personalities in the morning. They are headstrong about certain decisions that have been made. Sometimes I get them to listen to me, and sometimes I don't.
Right.
That's just a fact. Now, I'm not going to say whether or not that contributed to the decision that they made. you know, you'd have to ask them what the real reason was. But I'll say this to you. The year after I left, mm-hmm. I was at the NAB convention in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And I bumped into Pat Paxton, who's the current president of programming. Great guy. Good broadcaster.
One of my favorites.
He and I have had always had a great relationship when I was here. And he said to me that sometimes decisions are made that you don't want to make. But it was a tough decision. And I said, okay, it's been a year. I'm moving on. I'm on to other things. And I appreciate you saying it, but it is what it is. And I never held, I mean, I was disappointed for sure, but I was not angry. I'm not bitter. I didn't have any preconceived notions about things I was going to do or say. I mean, this company treated me exceptionally well, and I have no qualms about how they treated me at the end, except the fact that I was hoping to get more time to try to revive us, to fix it, and I didn't.
All right. Thanks again for listening to the Enough About Me podcast. Actually, you know what? I'm really not thankful at all. You should be thanking me. You get this shit every week, these great podcasts, totally free. Do me a favor. Would you go to iTunes, download it, go to Stitcher, do the same, and leave a rating, leave a review. That's where you can help me out. This podcast is going to be number one again. I guarantee it. And you're going to help me along with the process. So for that, I guess at the end, maybe I will thank you. There's a lot of thank yous going back and forth. Here's the point. Fuck you.